50,000 babies poisoned by toxic milk in China. Inflation at 231 million% in Zimbabwe. Three men on trial in Holland for deliberately infecting strangers with HIV by injecting them at parties. A survey that says one in three British workers have quit a job because they disliked their co-workers so much. A drugs-related killing spree in Mexico City that brings the murder count there to 2,700 this year alone. That is just some of the news from the past few weeks. Don't have to look far to find news like that. That is the world that we live in. Every person who does not believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead has no reason to believe that it will ever be any different. Every person who does believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead has every reason to be sure that change is coming. The resurrection changes everything. That is why it has such prominence in each of the Gospels. That is why it is the theme of the preaching of the apostles in Acts. It is central to all that the Christian gospel is. It declares that a new world has begun already in the new life of Jesus Christ. A world that has left behind death and pain and tears and corruption and rape and abuse and loneliness and dissatisfaction. It declares that everyone connected to him by faith will follow him in that world and into that world soon. The resurrection, that is a shout of a new beginning that declares that there is a light at the end of a very dark tunnel. And of course, then, it also says something staggering about Jesus Christ. He is no ordinary run-of-the-mill person like you or I. And those who deny then that the resurrection happened opt out of their only route to hope in this dark world. But they also run straight in the face of the evidence. The resurrection was not something convenient thought up to provide a comfort blanket for needy people who thought, well, we're in this state, let's think of something to try and help us out, to get us through each day. Create a myth that will help us along, give us some kind of hope. False hope, but we can deal with that. No, it really happened. It's not religious fantasy. It is historical fact. If you read through John's Gospel from the beginning to the end, you will realize that the entire thing is a narrative retelling of the ordinary events seen by ordinary people in real time with their own eyes. And he relates those events up to chapter 19, and many, many people would not deny that that is a true account, but perhaps become slightly more sceptical when they reach chapter 20 and the resurrection. And the question, of course, is why? Why would that be the case? Why would he change in his account? He doesn't. If you simply read from chapter 19 to chapter 20, you'll see there's no difference in his retelling of events. It is a reliable witness of what people really saw. He does not modify his style to convey a switch to wishful thinking or to apocryphal legend telling. If you'd like something to compare, here is an apocryphal account of the resurrection of Jesus Christ found in the lesser known so-called Gospel of Peter. Here we go. Jesus is portrayed striding out of the tomb, supported on either side by two angels, and there is a cross behind them, which is also walking out behind out of the tomb, behind Jesus and the two angels. And then Jesus grows like some celestial cookie monster, so that his head pierces the clouds, and he walks on through Jerusalem in that fashion. Now, that is wacky, right? That is wacky. John chapter 20 is not. It's completely different to that. It is simply an account of what people saw. Four times in the verses 1 to 9 only, we are told that certain people saw certain things with their own eyes. And very importantly, with each additional instance of them seeing certain things, there is progress of understanding. That is, the resurrection was not an immediate conclusion jumped to rashly by emotionally unstable people and then proclaimed willy-nilly as truth, even though it was unsubstantiated. No, it involves steps of investigation, examination, rational thought. The first things witnessed on that morning did not lead to the right answer immediately. It took evaluation of the various pieces of evidence. It was all pieced together. And so, two questions then face the person who thinks that believing in the resurrection is daft. Two questions for you, if that's you, or for the person outside. One, what better alternative do you have for the hope of a better world? Answer it honestly. What better hope is there? What hope does the rest of the world proclaim? The resurrection of Jesus Christ does claim that we do have hope of a better world in him. Secondly, though, and vitally this morning, what better alternative fits the facts as recorded by history? To dismiss the resurrection on the grounds of scientific impossibility forgets the simple truth that science just describes things that have been observed at a very basic level. And I'm saying that this chapter is exactly that. It is describing things that have been observed. Now, if you do not permit science to encompass the possibility of a divine creator, then that's up to you. Now, many questions face then the skeptic. Many of you will be familiar with some of these arguments for the reality of the resurrection. For example, why was no gravesite venerated by Jesus' disciples if his body was indeed still there? Why did some holy tomb kind of not grow up where people visited the body of the Christ? Or why did the very anti-Jesus authorities, who would have wanted to show that he had not risen, why did they not produce a body? Why did the story gain credence if everyone really knew it was false when people could contradict it there and then? Why did people under the Roman persecution go to death rather than renounce this reality that they believed the resurrection? Why did they do that? Why did they die instead of renouncing it if it was all just a lie? Now, those are, of course, some of the things that many of you will know of and be familiar with those particular arguments, and very good they are too. But we are leaving all those this morning as background, really, and coming to simply the account which John gives us in these first 9 verses of his 20th chapter. We're restricting ourselves to that, and particularly to 3 things that were indisputably witnessed that Sunday morning. 3 things. The first thing is this. It's what Mary saw. What Mary saw. Mary saw the stone removed from the tomb. Mary, there on the first day of the week in verse 1, she gets up while it's still dark. She's not expecting Jesus to rise. She is planning to find him there still dead and wants to anoint his body. And she turns up at the tomb, and in verse 1, we are told that she only saw one thing, that the stone was removed from the tomb. That's all she saw, nothing else. And she runs off in haste to tell others about it. Now, Mary's assumption is this. The tomb must be empty. Her conclusion from that is found in verse 2. Someone must have stolen the body. Okay? Assumption, tomb empty. Conclusion, someone has stolen the body. Now, it was a fairly common thing in those days, grave snatching. It happened quite a lot. We're told by historians so much that an emperor later on, a few years later, Emperor Claudius in the Roman Empire, had to impose a death penalty for those who engaged in it. It was getting such a problem, stealing bodies from graves. Therefore, it's not too unlikely, and we mustn't be too harsh on Mary for thinking, oh, that's what's happened, because it was quite common. Someone has stolen the body. However, the problem with what Mary concluded was the thing she was building on, her assumption. She assumed the tomb was empty. She was wrong. The tomb was not empty. We will discover why that was the case in a moment. But all that we can conclude, all that she should have been able to deduce from what she saw, was simply this. Something has happened at the tomb of Jesus. That's all. That's stage one of the evidence, right? Something has happened. We can't tell what, but because the stone has been rolled away, it's what she saw, we can be sure that something had happened. Now, more information was needed for clearer conclusions than that. So it seems to me that in God's providence, she ran off to get some men who were perhaps slightly less inclined to unsteady emotional reactions. I'm not sure. But what they saw then takes things just a step further. So along comes John. He's the second person we need to deal with. What Mary saw, the stone removed from the tomb. What John saw, the strips of linen lying inside the tomb. Now, let me ask you a question. How would you steal a Mars bar? I'm not suggesting, particularly children, that you go to your shop around the corner and actually do. Okay, but if you to think, how would you steal a Mars bar if that was what you were planning to do? Now, just a Mars bar, mind you, of course. Not anything else. Just a chocolate bar. That's all you want. You don't want the wrapper. Of course, because you're going to throw away the wrapper anyway. It's just wasted. You can't eat it. You just want the bar, right? And so, you go to the shop. Of course, you take your Mars bar to the shelf. Wrapped up. Inconvenient, eh? So you need to peel the wrapper off, okay? And then put the Mars bar into your pocket. You carefully kind of try and reform the wrapper. Replace it on the shelf as well as you possibly can. So that nobody can tell that you've moved it. Then run off with the Mars bar, okay? Is that how you would steal a Mars bar? I think the answer that we'd all give, no, I'm assuming that, indicates that what John saw immediately discredits, proves to be false, what Mary concluded. In verse 5, we're told that he saw the strips of linen lying there inside the tomb. That is, he saw something beyond what Mary had seen. He sees that the tomb, of course, is not empty. Not quite empty. There is still something in it. Now, here is the point. What John saw tells us that if somebody had stolen the body, then their philosophy of thievery was that which I have just described with reference to Mars bars. Namely, uncommonly pernickety to the point of foolishness. Right? To unwrap something that you are about to steal, and then to replace the wrapping as it was there in the place that you found the thing you were trying to steal, that is a trait of a thief who is either not in their right mind or definitely not in a great hurry to get away with what they are stealing. Therefore, what John has seen testifies to stage two of the evidence. Stage one was something had happened at the tomb. Stage two is the body had not been stolen. It couldn't have been, because the grave clothes were still there. Now, if the tomb had been completely empty, it would have opened the door to the possibility of removal by the disciples, by the authorities, or by just plain robbers. But it wasn't completely empty, and that's the point. Genuine resurrection, therefore, was becoming more and more likely, but still the certainty and the manner of that resurrection was yet to be seen and concluded by the evidence of the next stage. And so we move on to what Peter and John both saw. They saw that the linen and the headcloth were separate. As we're told in verses 6 and 7, Simon Peter was behind him, arrived, went into the tomb, he saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. You see, Peter sees something extraordinary, he sees something extra about the grave clothes, extra to what John saw. They weren't just there, but they were arranged in a certain way. Here were the main lot of strips that had been rolled around Jesus' body, and separately then there was the folded up headcloth with daylight between the two. Headcloth there and the rest of the linen there. Now that peculiarity suggests that no one had even touched the clothes, let alone taken them away and put them back. But rather no one had even touched them. They were exactly as they had been when they were wrapped around Jesus' head and body. You see, when people of that time embalmed people who had died, they would wrap up the body separately to the head, and they would leave the neck and the face completely exposed. They wouldn't wrap around the head, but rather would twirl the strips around the headcloth, around the head in a particular way, so as to encase the head separately to the rest of the body. And they would then embalm the strips so that they became solid in a way. They would have a shape that was moulded by the head as they were stripped, as they were twirled round the head. So, after that rather long explanation, the point is that the grave clothes, as seen by John and Peter, were exactly the same as they had been when around the body of Jesus, but they were simply bodiless. Now, that was the clincher for John. It says, finally, the other disciple, verse 8, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw all this and believed. That's the clincher for John, that Jesus had risen from the dead. Well, why was that? Because, you see, every other ordinary explanation, as it were, requires the clothes to be disturbed from their resting place. If, for example, as is commonly proposed, Jesus had merely swooned on the cross, he hadn't really died, he had just become unconscious, then he'd been put in the grave, and then he'd regained consciousness there and got up and so on, and that was all it was. If you take that as your explanation, then Jesus would have resuscitated in the tomb, would have woken up, do what you do when you wake up, stretch, yawn, etc., all with the grave clothes still on him, right? Still wrapped up. Now, if that is what happened, let's just take that for a moment as a possibility, why would he have unwound himself and then put the grave clothes back as if they had been untouched? Why would he do that? With the neck size gap and the separate things and all that, why would he have done that? More than that, even, could he have somehow unwound and then reformed the headcloth into the shape of his head, the exact shape that only a human head lying inside it could have made? Could he have done that? I think such a feat would need a miracle. And if you're willing to believe in a miracle as your explanation for part of the evidence, then why not go the whole hog and believe in the miracle? The evidence points to the fact that Jesus Christ had bodily risen from the dead. And not only so, but he had done so in a particular way. He had entered a new kind of existence, the kind that leaves a man free to choose whether or not he will deign to be fettered by the constraints of a previous physical existence. He was free to choose, in that sense, whether he would be constrained by the grave clothes anymore, On this occasion, he chooses not to be, and he comes straight through them, leaving them as they were when he was in them, but walking free from them. Now then, John is the only gospel writer, actually, to mention these details about the grave clothes. Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't mention. That's interesting, because it forms an interesting parallel with that other famous resurrection that, again, only John also records, namely that of Lazarus. In chapter 11 of his gospel, Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't mention that either. But he've got John talking about Lazarus and John talking about the grave clothes with Jesus. You see, there with Lazarus, also, if you look back later in the day perhaps, you'll find that John there makes mention again of the linen and of the headcloth. But the distinctive thing about Lazarus, of course, was that he came out still wrapped up, very much so, bound by the grave clothes he had been wearing. And Jesus has to say, do you remember? Unbind him and let him go. However, while Lazarus had come out wrapped up, Jesus has left the wrapping behind. And in that, there is the hint that he left everything of the old life behind. There is a particular and distinctive difference about Jesus' resurrection to every other resurrection that happened in the history of mankind through the Old Testament and into the Gospels. It's not the same. You see, the resurrection of Jesus teaches us something about human existence. What is human existence made up of in its totality? It's made up of three stages. Mortal life, the life which you live in now, where death and disease and pain come to us all, and which will end one day. Okay, mortal life, stage one. Temporary death, stage two. You will die, you will be dead, you will be conscious of the fact that you are dead in your spirit, either in heaven or in hell. That is stage two. But then, for the believer, immortal life, that's stage three. Okay, mortal life, temporary death, immortal life. The resurrection of Jesus teaches us that while Lazarus' resurrection was a return back from stage two to stage one, he returned back to the mortal life, to pain and suffering and disease. He would die again. But with Jesus, his resurrection was a progression from stage two to stage three, from death to immortal life, where the constraints of disease and suffering and pain and death again would never touch him ever again. He was free from all that now. He was moving on to a life that even he had not yet known so far. He'd not just left death behind, he'd left this life behind as well. Now he lives forever in the power of an endless life, the rest of the New Testament teaches us, in a spiritual body that Paul describes for us later on in 1 Corinthians. Quite exactly the detail of what that means is, I think, at the moment at least, beyond our comprehension. And yet we are and can be sure that that life is a physical existence, but it is totally and gloriously controlled and filled and characterized by the Holy Spirit. And so there, Jesus is dwelling in a physical, spiritual realm that, although we can't comprehend, is glorious and unending. Therefore, we come to stage three of the conclusion that we can make, that not just something had happened, not just that the body had been stolen, but rather Jesus Christ had risen from the dead and had done so as a progression to this glorious new realm, thus setting him apart from every other human being who's ever lived. It's no surprise then, if we can come to that conclusion from the evidence there in the first nine verses of John's Gospel, it's no surprise when you read on his account that indeed he himself was physically seen by Mary, and then by 10 disciples at once, and then by 11 disciples at once, and then by 7 disciples at once, all within John's Gospel. And unless they were all bizarrely hallucinating at the same time, I think it's very hard to get around the fact that Jesus Christ, in the history of the world which you live in, rose from the dead and continued to be alive the following week, and the following week, and the following week, and every Sunday, and every Sunday, and every month, and every year, and down through the ages, until he has still continued to be alive this morning. Now, here's where things get great for every person who believes in the resurrection, and where everything gets very uncomfortable for every person who does not. The honest, ordinary people who were there say that Jesus Christ rose from the dead because they saw it. John, for example, he wasn't expecting it. He wasn't planning for it. We can be sure from verse 9 that that's the case. They didn't understand from Scripture all the same that Jesus had to rise from the dead. They weren't saying, well, the prophecies say, so we'll expect when we get to the tomb there he'll be. No, they weren't expecting that at all. And yet he saw and believed that this had happened. And he wrote down what he saw. That is, he saw death, pain, trouble, suffering, grief, tears left behind by a human being. I know it's very hard for us to comprehend quite what that could mean. But that's what he saw with his own eyes. He recognized that this man, therefore, was on a completely different level to the rest of humanity, especially now. All that he'd said had come true. All he claimed was proved to be right. He knew, John knew, that Jesus had been right all along when he said, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. It was finally and gloriously confirmed to John in his resurrection from the dead. He eclipses, therefore, all other pretenders to our worship. He is the reference point by which Muhammad and Buddha and Darwin are judged. They are not all equal. Whether you like it or not, whether a policeman would arrest me for saying it or not, the world will bow at the feet of Jesus Christ alone and none other. And you will be there doing it. Not believing in the resurrection does not stop facts being facts. But it does put you on the wrong side of the argument and the wrong side of this man. It declares you a rebel against him. The man declared to be the Son of God by power, in power, by his resurrection from the dead. It leaves you waiting to meet him with your fingers in your ears, refusing to submit to the truth. When you know, when you can read, when the record says, this is who he is, this is what has happened, this is the world he's begun, and you are at present not going to be a part of it because your faith is not in him. But you will be away from that world, left behind, out of that world, and you will continue in a world worse than this one, where the pain and the sorrow and the tears and the death just keep going, worse and worse and worse. How dangerous! What danger you're in! I do not know who here is in that position, because I don't know very many of you. But if you are in that position, if you refuse to believe that Jesus Christ is who he said he is, you are in the most terrifying position you could ever be in. How will you approach him on that day when he comes to judge the world? What will you say to him when the evidence was so clear before your eyes this very morning? He will ask you what you did with it. He will say to you, was it not obvious? Did John not write what he saw? Was he concocting a religious fraud? Or was he saying, this is the Lord and God of the universe. Come and bow. I'm writing so that you may believe and know him for yourself. How dangerous your position, and yet how foolish your position. It just doesn't make sense. It's needless, because this Christ is the one who, by his very resurrection from the dead, says to you that a new start is open to you. Open to you if you will believe in him, that your sins can be forgiven, your rejection of him can be overcome, can be reversed, so that you can be brought back to God and reconciled with God through his death, through his new life. Who else promises you the removal of sin and the beginning not just of a new life but of a new world? No one else does. No one else promises a world flushed clean of lust and envy and malice and abuse and the corruption that exists not just out there but in here, in my heart. Don't I know it? And in your heart. He promises a world free of that. If you won't come to him for that, if you won't bow to him today, If you won't turn away from your rebellion and turn to him for forgiveness, then I assure you, on the authority of the holy word of Almighty God, you too will be flushed away with the corruption and the vileness and the pollution to hell forever. And I don't want you to go there. But if you come and get this, receive his new life, come and start again, come and be forgiven, come and give in to him, then you will know his new life in yourself and for yourself forever. The facts are clear. He is alive. So it leaves you faced with him and asking yourself what you're going to do.